You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 27th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the programme, Israel removes new security barriers at the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem so quickly as to prompt the question of why they put them there in the first place. Rolling Stone magazine's profile of Justin Trudeau is not much of an advertisement for Rolling Stone, but does it do Trudeau any good? We'll find out why two Swedish ministers have resigned over an IT debacle and why it could yet bring down the government and...
That's right, these food championships are considered a sport, and probably one of few sports where you would come out weighing more than when you went into the event.
We will visit the Canadian Food Championships and meet Portuguese street artist Vils.
Usually I work with non-icons, so people that I everyday heroes that live in the cities where I work. I do a series of portraits and I try to capture the essence of the city. And this was one of the first sets of drawings that I did when I was living in London.
All that and more besides coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. US President Donald Trump's unilateral attempt to disbar transgender people from the US military via Twitter has prompted predictable bewilderment. General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has written to senior commanders to instruct them that nothing will change until or unless Trump formally directs Secretary of Defense James Mattis, who must then implement guidelines. In other Trump news, the chief scout executive of the Boy Scouts of America has apologized for the president's bizarre speech at the Boy Scouts National Jamboree earlier this week. France has said it intends to establish what it calls hotspots for migrants in Libya, hoping to dissuade people from risking the perilous Mediterranean crossing, which has claimed at least 2,300 lives this year. France's president, Emmanuel Macron, said that the new processing centres would be ready this summer. Macron said that somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million people were currently in camps in Libya hoping to get to Europe, but that many were not entitled to asylum. Former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili has been stripped of citizenship for the second time in his eventful career, having lost his Georgian citizenship when he accepted Ukraine's eccentric offer to become governor of Odessa in 2015. He has now lost his Ukrainian passport on the orders of Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. No official reason has been given. Mr. Saakashvili, who quit the Odessa gig last year, insists that he will fight to return to Ukraine. And a Nigerian man who was charged with breaching the peace after naming his dog after the country's president, Muhammadu Buhari, has been acquitted after charges were dropped. The prosecution's case against Joachim Iroko, a market trader from Ogun State, was perhaps fatally undermined from the off when a spokesman for President Buhari cheerfully admitted that his boss was enormously amused by the homage. Mr. Iroko explained that he was in the habit of naming his dogs after his heroes. Other pets include Nelson Mandela and Barack Obama. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. In Jerusalem tonight, Muslim worshippers have returned to the Haram al-Sharif for Friday prayers for the first time in a fortnight following the removal of security apparatus installed by Israel after the killing of two Israeli police officers in the vicinity on July 14th. Protests against the security gates had occasioned violence which left another seven people dead. Further injuries have been reported in fresh clashes today as police tried to keep crowds under some sort of control. I'm joined with more by Daniela Peled, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Daniela, first of all, why were the metal detectors controversial in the first place? I know there are different entrances to the Temple Mount, but I can remember going through metal detectors leading from the Western Wall Plaza in 2005.
Yeah, absolutely. And this has been something that's been very prominent in the messaging from the Israeli government. The fact is that such metal detectors and security measures are standard at holy sites throughout Israel and around the world, and a standard security measure. The issue here is one of sovereignty. The site obviously is holy to Jews and Muslims, the control over the Temple Mount itself is supposed to be by the Waqf, which is the Muslim authority. And it was that's where the tension comes, that it was a unilateral Israeli decision. They were going to install these metal detectors, and then there was some talk about security cameras and so on. It was interpreted as a sign of an overt sign of their control, and crucially, an attempt to change the status quo on the Temple Mount, where matters are so sensitive. Anything that seems to change this very fragile modus vivendi between the religions and the nationalities is extremely sensitive.
Is the speed with which Israel has about faced here surprising?
Well, it is kind of surprising. From one point of view, I mean, from the other, you know, very soon after the decision was taken, army security and the Shin Bet, the internal security intelligence forces in Israel, both warned Netanyahu that it was an extremely bad idea, and that any benefits of security from installing these metal detectors would be completely outweighed by the violence they might spark. So the idea that there would have to be standing down was, it seemed inevitable. But I mean, it seems that Netanyahu's decision to persist as long as he did is taken more rather than security concerns, by not wanting to appear weak in front of his country, and more importantly, the right-wing members of his coalition, who he depends on to stay in power. And they've all been making merry weather out of this turnaround and this climb down, which has been very controversial. Even Israel Hayom, which is the most widely read paper in Israel, basically a free sheet dedicated to supporting him and funded by one of his biggest fans in the US, even they published a headline saying that it was a weak and senseless decision.
It is far from the most pressing consequence of the security barriers being installed. Seven people are dead and many, many more are injured. But is Netanyahu going to be politically injured by this? And is this perhaps why he spent much of today threatening to throw Al Jazeera out of Israel?
Well, Al Jazeera is an easy target. This isn't the first time that senior Israeli figures have been rather rude about them and their in apparently insightful present. But yeah, he's taking other measures as well. I don't think it's any coincidence that yesterday he announced that there would be a bill that would bring nearby settlement blocks under the auspices of the Jerusalem municipality, something which is perhaps legally dubious and hard to really work out how that would happen, and is in any case being kicked down the road to later this year. But it's quite a clear sop to right-wing members of his coalition, and indeed, you know, showing himself as a strong on security, but he's taking those steps. He also made there was also, in part of the violence this whole crisis has spurred, there was something almost approximating to a siege on the Israeli embassy in Jordan, and the staff were evacuated and so on. He's made a really, really big deal about that and the danger that they were in, and bringing them back to bring the security detail back to Israel as heroes. So I think he's really trying to distract from what has been an embarrassing climb down by him, although a sensible move.
Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, reacted to the barriers going up by saying that he would freeze all cooperation and contact with Israeli authorities. Latest word is that he intends to maintain that freeze regardless of the barriers being taken down again. How long is that likely to last, and what practical consequence is it going to have?
Well, the most practical contact that Israel and PA have is on security cooperation in the West Bank, which has meant for many years that the situation has been remarkably calm and stable, and it carries on at a very high level, which has also reduced the PA status in the eyes of many Palestinians as just basically acting as policemen for Israel. But this crisis has also proved a very notably unifying phenomenon amongst Palestinian society. Not only PA and Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank, Hamas have supported it, obviously, and also it's been something of a bridge between Palestinian citizens of each Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem, who have different identity card system than Palestinians in the West Bank, and Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza. So it really has been a unifying cause for protest and struggle, and also the way in which the non-violent protests in which there have been mass prayers held outside the Temple Mount compound instead has also been, you know, quite a stunning act of civil protest too.
Israel possibly attempting to save some face here says that at some point it will replace the obvious three-dimensional metal detectors with other forms of surveillance. Is that likely to be any more popular?
Well, I think tensions are extremely high at the moment, and they periodically erupt over the Temple Mount. It's highly symbolic for all concerned, and as I said, it's the issue of sovereignty, and it's also the appearance of sovereignty. So the idea of security on the Temple Mount is not going to go away. Israel will always reserve the right to step in and arbitrate. But I think for now, like with Netanyahu's call to bring the nearby settlement under the auspices of Jerusalem, I think they're kicking it down the road to deal with it.
Daniela Pallad from the IWPR, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been treated to the probably inevitable fawning 6,500-word hagiography in Rolling Stone, complete with soft-focus cover and the wistful headline, "Why Can't He Be Our President?" It is not the first time that Trudeau has benefited from comparison to his counterpart south of the border, though few wouldn't, in fairness. But the response to Rolling Stone's weird article has reminded Trudeau that not all good publicity is necessarily good publicity. I'm joined now by Thomas Lewis, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief. Thomas, I have read the article, as doubtless you have as well. For the benefit of our listeners who haven't, how weird is it exactly?
Well, it's interesting you use the word weird, because that's exactly what my impression was, frankly.
Great minds, Thomas, great minds.
Absolutely. I've always known we were like two peas in a pod, Andrew. It's kind of an extended postcard, really, and sort of a Canada, you know, sort of 101 almost, I think. You know, there are so many tidbits about, you know, how big Canada is, you know, kind of how Canada's parliamentary sort of government works, even little hints to that. You know, the sort of impression is you kind of need to be reading this really not as a Canadian. And I think that, you know, a lot of the reaction to it here in the press, at least, and a lot of the columnists who very, very, very quick to write their responses to it, you know.
Really, well, I mean, if you are Canadian, you're going to know, obviously, that Justin Trudeau leads the Liberal Party, not the Liberty Party, as it says in the piece, and it's the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, not Mountain. I'm sure Rolling Stone used to retain sub-editors at some point in the distant past. But as you point out, it's getting what you might, I guess, tactfully describe as a mixed reaction in Canada.
Absolutely. I think this notion that it's a pretty fluffy piece, if you're reading it in Canada, has been pretty, you know, well sort of discussed, really, either online or in lots of the newspaper columns here of the past day or two. You know, this idea that, you know, this is quite a broad brush, quite fawning, very glowing kind of look at this kind of rock star poster boy prime minister. And again, like you say, this is all through the prism of, well, the occupant of the White House at the moment is none of those things. And, you know, I think we're at a time in Justin Trudeau's premiership where there are a lot of questions emerging. And I think one of the interesting kind of responses to have come from, say, you know, Canadians is that this is the latest in a long line of very high profile media sort of opportunities, media interviews that Justin Trudeau has done. And of course, he's played the PR game very well since he won the election in 2015. But a lot of people seem to be saying, well, look, can we just get our prime minister to be prime minister, please, and not sort of sit on the front page of yet another magazine, be it the onboard magazine of Delta Airlines recently or the front page of a cottaging life magazine kind of somewhere else in Canada. You know, there's kind of this sense that it's great to have such a sort of, you know, prominent face on the world stage to fly the flag for their country. But there are lots of issues that are boiling here. And this is where one of, I guess, the politics of this comes in, is that the Conservative Party have really tried to make a bit of political capital over this pretty sort of, you know, sort of fluffy kind of 6,500-word profile, as you say, Andrew, and try to make sort of political capital of it as well.
But are they not going a bit overboard themselves? The Conservatives, as I understand it, are trying to insist that this interview somehow jeopardises NAFTA. And that, I mean, of course, that's assuming that anybody involved with NAFTA stays awake through the entire thing. But even so, I'm not sure I can see how this is going to work.
Well, exactly. I think, you know, going overboard is a fair way of putting it. But they are responding to the Liberals' responses to another political story that happened last week when two Conservative members of Parliament appeared on Fox News in the United States discussing the settlement to Omar Khadr, which is a government settlement. He was the youngest detainee, as we've discussed on the Monocle Daily several times, at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. The government issued a formal apology, offered him $10.5 million Canadian dollars worth of a settlement for the apparent complicity of Canadian security personnel in his detention in Guantanamo Bay. Those interviews on Fox News drew a huge amount of criticism from the Liberal Party, who suggested that they were themselves, you know, sort of messing up the relationship between the United States and various other things domestically too. So this is kind of a coming back at you kind of thing from the Conservatives, I think. You know, the article does touch on kind of this notion of the NAFTA renegotiations that are looming. You know, it's well known here in Canada, at least, that, you know, lots of provincial leaders and Trudeau himself have been courting state governors, for example, in the United States directly away from the White House, seeing what can be done on a province to state kind of level, on an Ottawa to US state kind of level too. So, you know, that is something that I think a lot of Canadians will, you know, have an opinion on, that, you know, Justin Trudeau, of course, shakes Donald Trump's hand very hard, but actually behind the scenes, there seems to be this keenness to, you know, keep business going without necessarily kind of the big formal involvement of Donald Trump too. So, yes, I think a pretty mixed response, a little political spat happening from it. I think that the response from the Trudeau government to the criticism by the Conservatives was also slightly overblown, to be totally honest. I think, you know, they again sort of answered in these quite glowing tones of, you know, the interests of all Canadians, and that actually doing an interview in Rolling Stone really sort of showed the collaboration and cooperation between Canada and the US, which I think is a bit of a stretch, frankly. But yes, I think this political storm side of it will blow over pretty quickly. But I think the questions about, you know, Justin Trudeau's readiness to jump in front of a camera, jump in front of a news reporter, you know, may actually start gaining traction as some of these big issues like NAFTA, even things like the postal service here, which is, you know, becoming another sort of row, which was a big campaign promise, which is now being backed off from a little bit. You know, those will, I think, begin to take centre stage.
I mean, is it fair to say that there's a slight mischance of timing here from Trudeau's point of view? Because it was always going to get to the point at which Canadians, you know, while I guess being glad that people like their prime minister, who's a, you know, a good looking chap with an affable and plausible manner, but started to wonder exactly what is he doing all day, and has this cover arrived at exactly that moment?
I think it has to a certain degree. I mean, I think, you know, as Donald Trump himself is finding, you know, that PR, playing the sort of game, you know, when you stand in front of 40,000 Boy Scouts, for example, and you start sort of spewing obscenities about various things, well, you know, some people are going to have an issue with that. You know, that's something that Trudeau is absolutely on the opposite end of the scale on, you know, from wearing rainbow socks, you know, ahead of a pride parade, for example, or appearing as the first sitting prime minister in a pride parade. He did so again this year in Toronto with his entire family in tow. You know, even from things, you know, from cuddling pandas at a zoo, or, you know, kind of breaking sort of scientific equations in front of a pack of journalists. You know, all of that stuff is actually quite important if you're a prime minister and if you are, you know, a politician and you want to sort of get a message across. You know, I guess there is this, you know, well-oiled sense of, you know, people kind of need to like you. But I think, you know, when really questioned, and I think this is something that the Rolling Stone article does touch on, actually, you know, is that, you know, he's very on script. And that's something you hear a lot from journalists here in Canada who cover the Trudeau government, whereas there is, you know, in the visuals, a huge contrast between his predecessor, the Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who was a micromanager, never really spoke to the press, you know, controlled every aspect of government, that actually Trudeau looks very open-armed and very welcoming, but actually the message control is incredibly tight too. And I think in this the article, the just a final point, they pick that up quite nicely, where he's at some ice cream social and then the motorcade, after they've left this, turns off down a dirt road. They wonder what, the reporter wonders why, and then he sees the window of Trudeau's car come down and the ice cream gets thrown out of the window away from the watching press. So I think, you know, there is of course this need to be a kind of a charismatic, PR-able kind of guy in this kind of time that we're in, but I think also there are questions raising about the actual government of Canada that are, you know, very worthwhile and will continue as many of these issues start to sort of get their teeth, if you like.
Thomas Lewis, our Toronto Bureau Chief, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, the minority government of Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven is down two ministers in a crisis occasioned by the mishandling of sensitive data. Infrastructure Minister Anna Johansson and Interior Minister Anders Ygeman have walked the plank in the wake of a scandal over a security breach caused by the ill-considered outsourcing of the country's transport agency's IT maintenance. Well, joining me with more on this is Jack Lance, a reporter for Sveriges Radio. Jack, I know this has been rolling on for some time, this story. If you could take us back briefly to the beginning and remind us of basically what went wrong here.
From the very beginning, as you say, this has been a long and complicated story. It dates back to the year of 2012, when the transport agency of Sweden decided to outsource some of the data material to IBM, and they did not properly do the security checks on the people who were going to work with the data. And this, some of this data was highly secret and regarding personal information and also regarding vehicles that could be used for by police, for example. So when this was rolled up in the media, it has had already been going on for many years. And what also went public was that some of the ministers, namely two of the ministers, had known this for quite some time, since early 2016. But they had not informed the prime minister, and they had not informed the minister that was in charge of the transport agency. And that is why they have no, the opposition parties had called for a vote of no confidence in these three ministers, namely the two ministers that knew and the minister that was in charge but did not inform herself of this, Anna Johansson.
Do we know if there were any, you know, real-world detrimental consequences to this information not being secured?
As far as the intelligence office and the police have said, they don't know that there has been any such occurrences, no.
And do we know specifically what information was made available and who would have had access to it?
Yes, there was all kinds of information. One kind of information was all the photos of the people for driving licenses, so that these people, this kind of information went accessible to people of the Czech Republic, who worked with this, so they could have all the names and the photos of these people. Also, there was information about people that had secret addresses because of being followed by other people and so on, and people can have secret addresses for lots of different reasons, and these kind of people got their addresses and their names leaked to people working with this.
So as we've been discussing, this has been going on for some time. Why has it only just come to a head now with the resignations of these two ministers?
That is because the Swedish public service TV station, they dug into this. They started when they looked at the resignation of the head, the chief executive of the transport agency. And it was said that she left because of different opinions with the minister in charge. But then they figured out that she had in fact committed these crimes, as it turned out, and that she had got a fine from the intelligence agency. And then this was all rolled out, and then all the ministers were asked, when did they first get the knowledge?
And is the sacrifice of these two ministers going to be deemed to be sufficient? Is Stefan Löfven going to be able to keep his government in power?
That is the question we all are asking ourselves now. And the opposition parties officially say that this is not enough. However, I have spoken to some of the members of parliament of the two liberal parties, of these opposition parties. There are two more right-wing parties and two liberal parties. And some of these members of parliament say that they could withdraw the vote of no confidence in this last minister, the Minister of Defence, who has not yet resigned. And they could do this and withdraw the vote if they receive new information during the course of the ongoing investigation that say that maybe he did not be as faulty as the two other ministers.
And how is this playing in, I guess, local newspapers, local media? Is there much sympathy for the Prime Minister, or are they baying for blood?
Well, that depends on what kind of newspapers you look at. We have both the left-wing leaning and the right-wing leaning newspapers, and you get different opinions from these two sides. So I can't say that it's just one way.
Jack Lance from Sveriges Radio, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, currently underway in New York City is the Urban Resilience Summit, which gathers together over 500 urban leaders, practitioners and city activists to discuss how to build better and, there's a clue in the title, more resilient cities. Monocle's Carlotta Ribello is there. Yesterday we heard from her on a boat. Today, however, she's tracked down Michael Berkowitz, the president of the 100 Resilient Cities Network. We join their discussion with Michael explaining what that network is all about.
So 100 Resilient Cities is the Rockefeller Foundation's commitment to build urban resilience worldwide. It was founded in 2013 to celebrate the foundation's 100th anniversary. And we've been in the process over the last 4 years of selecting 100 cities around the world to help them build resilience to the shocks or the sudden events that they face, as well as to the long-term chronic stresses that might degrade a city's capacity over time.
Now, you, on the first day of the summit, you walked us through the process, how it started, you know, with just a few of you and just a couple of cities, and now we have the full 100 cities. We spoke earlier in the year when you announced the final names. This is the first summit you're doing where everyone is now part of the network. How has it been so far to finally have all of these CROs in the same room?
Well, I think one of the things that we're finding is that we're now talking about the how as opposed to the what. You know, urban resilience was such a new concept in 2013 that we were really talking about what it is. What is urban resilience? And what does it mean for my city? And that, I think, partly because we're more mature and because this discipline is more mature, but also because we're larger, that we're now talking about how. How do we do it better? How do we engage partners? How do we do implementation? How do we crowd in resources in order to actually get cities to do projects on the ground that affect their citizens and make their cities stronger, more livable, more sustainable, more resilient? So that's been a big change.
Now, as I've been here in the summit all week and speaking with several people and several of the CROs or deputy CROs, it's funny how for all of them, with all the challenges that each particular city has, it's also about making sure people get what resilience is. That is not just about earthquakes and floods. There's way more to it. Is that has been the process for you as well to try to, you know, make sure that term comes through and gets to people the true meaning of it?
Yeah, I think that's true. But the difference between now and 2013 is in 2013, we were one of the few who are actually saying that. And now we have many, many voices who understand that message and can bring real life illustrations to it. And to give you an example of why it's not just about earthquakes and floods, you know, think about New Orleans, which was impacted by Katrina a little more than a decade ago. Of course, New Orleans' risk to another storm event has to do with climate change and how warm the Gulf of Mexico is and how high the seas are and the state of the infrastructure. But what urban resilience tries to get us to understand is that New Orleans' risk is also about the state of transportation and poverty and public health and racism and the government institutions that serve and the big city institutions that serve the people. All of those things have as much to do with the risks around another storm as the actual storm itself. And so this idea that these things are so fundamentally interconnected is something that in 2013 was a big, bold new idea, and now today feels like it's much better accepted.
And are you happy with that, the fact that people know what you're talking about?
Yes. I mean, yeah. And I think some of it has to do with us and all of the blood, sweat, and tears we've shed in order to create this movement and work with these cities. But the reality of it is it's also gathering steam because this is true in cities. You know, when Paris applied to our program in 2014, they wanted to talk about environmental things around flooding and urban heat island effect and air pollution, which are critical issues in Paris. And then 2015 happened with two terrorist attacks and a refugee crisis. And what urban resilience does is challenge us to think about those things together. How, as you're meeting the commitments to COP21 and your climate goals, do you also integrate the suburbs that sit around the outside of Paris when you roll out new green infrastructure or bike share or bus rapid transit, all things that you might do in order to meet your climate commitments? Can you think about integrating those suburbs that have the most migrants and immigrants, the newest members of French society, to make yourself safer and more cohesive so that you're able to withstand whatever the next event is, whether it's a flood, an economic shock, or a terrorist attack?
That was Michael Berkowitz, the president of the 100 Resilient Cities Network. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Time now for some sport after a fashion. Edmonton recently hosted the Canadian Food Championships. I'm really not sure this is sport, but let's stick with it and see how it goes. In which 90 competitors compete for the tastiest plate across seven different categories. Still not sounding like sport, but anyway. They have 1 hour to make their creation with one secret ingredient allowed, hopefully talent. The winner then progresses to the World Food Championships in Alabama this November. Monocle's Sheena Rossiter was in Edmonton for a champion feed.
Ready? 3, 2, 1, up! Whoa! Oh my God! Very good!
It's down to the wire. There's only 10 minutes left to make the best sandwich in the country. Sweat drips from the competitors' brows as they feel both the heat from the kitchen and the crowd to be the top chef in the sandwich category in the Canadian Food Championships.
Oh, and we have the first plates coming to the table. Instagrammers, find your positions.
The Canadian Food Championships, a branch off of the World Food Championships franchise, is a more recent addition to the ongoing summer event here in the Alberta capital, Edmonton, only becoming part of the city's annual food festival, A Taste of Edmonton, 3 years back.
And we are officially at the 10-minute mark, ladies and gentlemen.
Paul Lucas is a general manager from Events Edmonton, the non-for-profit behind the organization of the annual event. He explains why the Canadian Food Championships have become part of the event.
The Canadian Food Championships, the reason why we brought it here is we're a non-profit charitable association, and our event was becoming very stagnant, so we wanted to grow it, and we thought what better way to do it than to grow it in the areas of food sport.
That's right, these food championships are considered a sport, and probably one of few sports where you would come out weighing more than when you went into the event. But not just anyone can throw their hat in the ring to compete. Paul Lucas explains how competitors get here.
The way the competition works is we've got 8 feeder events across Canada. Saskatchewan Bacon Festival, as an example, their top 2 or top 3 were invited to come here and compete in the bacon category. So we've got those kinds of feeder events. So that's how the feeder events work. The other way we allow people in is through a wild card. So it's not just about being in a competition. So if you've got the best pasta dish, or we take a look at the recipe and then allow them in. So the event, actually, the way it's judged, it's double blind judged. It's judged on the EAT mythology, which is execution, appearance, and taste. Taste accounting for 50% of the vote.
Competing across categories such as chicken, steak, bacon, sandwich, burger, dessert, and seafood, competitors here can enter into as many categories as they want. Each round of competition is closely judged by a group of judges, like Valerie Bellalenda, who is judging the chicken and burger categories this year. And she knows what it's like to be on both sides of the grill.
How I got involved with the CFCs is actually the first year I competed in burger, and then this last year I judged as well, and so this year I fully became certified and loving it. It's awesome.
So you competed the first year, and can you tell us a little bit about what the experience was like being a competitor? Is it a lot of pressure?
Oh my gosh, there's so much pressure, and especially being a judge now and being able to judge the same category, it gave me a whole new perspective. When you're on that side of the fence, there's so much adrenaline and pressure, and it's challenging, and you're really against the clock. And these competitors, they give everything they've got for that 1 hour of cook time. It's amazing. So amazing.
Taking a bit of a break from the food competition, I venture out to experience the nibbles that A Taste of Edmonton has to offer. On recommendation, I head over to Norman's stand, where I get my hands on some braised beef short ribs and mashed. Here's Chef Norman Campbell telling us about his Alberta-infused food.
We're doing cold smoked bison carpaccio with a little grainy Dijon vinaigrette. It's kind of like I call it meat candy. It's really good. And then the really popular dish is the braised beef short rib and mashed potatoes.
Why is it so popular?
Well, it's been braised, and it's just a good little meal. It's the beef falls apart. You can take it. You don't need a knife. It's a fork. And the sauce is done. There's a couple little secrets in there. There's wine, and there's a little cinnamon. And it's just so tasty that people come back every year for it. They just love it.
Now, even though it's geographically far from the cosmopolitan hub that is Canada's largest city, Toronto, the national identity of multiculturalism and diversity shines through. Restaurants from all over the city have shown up to give festival goers a small taste of what they have to offer. Lined up side by side, you can get everything from an authentic shawarma, authentic spanakopita can be tasted as part of the Greek restaurant Katuki stand.
I'll get a lemongrass here, please.
And just 2 stalls down, authentic Vietnamese lemongrass skewers can be sampled at Luen Hung's stand. And chefs here haven't shied away from a new level of fusion foods.
So outside looks Ukrainian, inside it's all Indian.
Like at Pack Rat Louis' stand, where we can take the traditional Ukrainian dumpling, the pierogi, and infuse it with Indian masala spice in its chicken masala pierogies with caramelized onions and tamarind sour cream. And around the corner at Lamar's food truck, I get my hands on some Mexican shrimp tostadas with spicy chimichurri sauce, created by Victor Hugo Ryman, originally from Mexico City, but who's called Edmonton home for the past 8 years. He also takes part in this year's Canadian Food Championships, competing in the seafood category, along with his partner, Larissa Martinez. They tell us about what they cooked up at the competition.
It's very awesome. One of my favorite events in the city. We make a shrimp taco with our signature sauce with scallops. Scallops was the secret ingredient.
And how did you do?
Well, the camera people always go and look for us because he's a showman. When he cooks, he's a showman. So and I you should have seen him last year. Yeah. He prepared this fantastic, very conspicuous octopus. You could see it everywhere, Instagram, Twitter. The providers were also taking a look, taking a picture of it. And he went around all the social media. And it was his dish. He didn't win, but the picture and the dish was the most posted everywhere.
The Canadian Food Championships have clearly rejuvenated a traditional food festival in Edmonton, sparking creativity and friendly competition. But it also has highlighted the growing food scene in this growing food city, showing that restaurant diversity is now something that can be seen across Canada.
Here we go. Canadian Food Championships. 3, 2, 1. Oh!
For Monocle in Edmonton, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
That was Sheena Rossiter at the Canadian Food Championships in Edmonton, Alberta. Still doesn't sound like sport. But to hear that and more food and drink stories, tune into The Menu. The new episode premieres tomorrow at 1900 London time. You can, of course, catch up with that and all our other shows anytime you like on our website, iTunes, SoundCloud, etc. Coming up, our review of the Asian newspapers.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
They've reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's Week That Was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits of all our magazine shows, from The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneurs, Culture to Section D, premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or on SoundCloud to ensure that you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
Time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We are joined once again by John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, among other postings. John, first of all, to Channel News Asia. And, well, Amazon, say whatever else you will about it, and there are criticisms that can be made of it, but it, as its logistics, its customer service have been the making of it. But in Singapore in particular, it seems to be interested in trying to step it up even further.
Yes, that's right. Amazon Prime being launched in Singapore with an option for a two-hour delivery slot, which you can get over a certain spend, or for paying another, I think it's nearly $5 Singapore, or even a one-hour delivery, which you get for paying an extra $10 Singapore. And to do this, Amazon has built one of its biggest fulfillment centers anywhere in the Amazon network, With new software, new intelligent tools of all kinds, very carefully linked into a system of delivery drivers who will somehow have to cope with Singapore's increasingly difficult traffic. So a big move by Amazon. But the thing on this story I wanted to focus on was what Channel News Asia and indeed the rest of the Singapore media very carefully aren't saying. Everybody knows that Singapore is Redmart territory, and Redmart belongs to Lazada, which belongs to Alibaba. This is therefore the first time that Amazon and Alibaba, the two arch rivals, have actually gone head to head in a market. Up till now, they've kind of had a, you wouldn't call it a gentleman's agreement, but they haven't actually trodden on each other's toes.
But is this the appeal for Amazon? Because I am sure Amazon has, I mean, it must have looked at China and thought, that is something we want.
Yes, I'm sure it's looked at China and said, this is something we want. Then it's looked at the way that you do business in China and at the strength of Alibaba and probably sucked its teeth, rather. But it has, for a long time, been looking at Southeast Asia. This is not just about Singapore. Singapore is the kickoff point. This is about Southeast Asia as a whole, 600 million consumers, big markets, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, all of which are Alibaba, not quite fiefdoms, but where Alibaba or its surrogates effectively run the online market, and it's quite clear that Amazon is going to do battle. This is going to be bloody. The winner is going to be the consumer. Already, Redmart, which is the local Alibaba manifestation in Singapore, has got a big banner all across the website saying, we've brought down all our prices.
Well, let's move along to Dawn from Pakistan and a story which is about the grimmest and most miserable thing anyone's likely to read this week, arguably this year. Unfortunately, it is merely one example of a not infrequent trend. This is the revenge attack upon entirely blameless women in order to avenge some absolutely imaginary sense of family or tribal honour.
Exactly. What has happened is that on 16th of July, a 12-year-old girl was raped by a young man while he was cutting grass out in a field in rural Pakistan. The girl's brother went and complained to the local elders, who decided that the way to administer justice was that he, the brother, should rape the sister of the alleged first rapist, a completely innocent and unassociated 16, 17-year-old girl, brought screaming to a room in the village where, in front of her parents and the entire council, she was raped by this young man. With considerable courage, the mothers of the two daughters, the article rather curiously says the parents, it was the mothers, took this case to the police, who, remarkably, because this doesn't always happen in Pakistan,
actually did
something about it, and have now tried to track down the people in that council who ordered the rape. 20-25 people involved, and, well, what can one say? The whole thing stinks. This is rural Pakistan at its sick worst, and one can only hope that these men are brought to justice. We have to remember that there was a famous case back in 2002 where something similar happened. A 28-year-old woman, Muktai Mai, was gang-raped by an order of a jirga, of a council court, because her younger brother had a relationship with an older woman. They were arrested, and then they were released by the Supreme Court. So not even if you can get into the judicial system do you have any guarantee of justice in Pakistan.
Moving along to a slightly more cheerful story, although literally any story would be slightly more cheerful than that. This one from Yonhap in South Korea. President Moon Jae-in has officially adopted a homeless dog, which, you know, is a cheerful, space-filling colour yarn anywhere. But in South Korea, it does, of course, have a certain amount of extra significance.
It does indeed, because this dog not only was homeless, he was rescued from a dog farm. In South Korea, still in 2017, there are people who think that it's all right to eat dogs. And there are farms that serve this, what we call it, a trade, where dogs are kept in the most revolting conditions. I was at an exhibition recently in Parliament, where they had immersive video of the cages in which the dogs are kept. No floors, they simply defecate through the cages, past the dogs below, onto stinking mounds on the ground. The stench is appalling, covered in sores, badly fed, badly watered. If you did that to a cow in South Korea, or almost anywhere in the developed world, your farm would be shut down, but dogs are not so controlled. So President Moon adopting a dog, a rescue dog from one of these farms, is a very strong political gesture, which will be noted. Let's just hope that it brings an end to this terrible trade in South Korea.
Is there, I mean, it is a weird area. The cruelty to the dogs is well established, but is it the kind of thing where there is agitation for the dog meat trade to be allowed to continue as long as the dogs are treated better, as ideally other farm animals would be, or is there a kind of abolitionist movement focused on dog meat to the exclusion of all other meats that people eat?
Mostly the latter. Simply dog's relationship with man has through history been rather different from cow's relationship with man. It's an interesting point. If you could have a legitimate dog meat industry with the same safeguards for the dogs as you get if you're another kind of domestic animal in South Korea, what would the reaction be? I don't think we're going to find out, because there seems to be a general move to one by one close down these dog farms. Interestingly, when approached by animal rights activists, most of the farm owners are only too glad to take alternative lifestyles, because not only are the farms just horrible, horrible places, they don't actually make much money, and these people are looking for a way out.
Moving along finally to New Zealand, and this is a report from Stuff in New Zealand, which is explaining how, I mean, yeah, it is what it is. Nearly $100,000 New Zealand dollars of taxpayers' money has been spent on buying mud from South Korea. I've been to New Zealand. It was a long time ago, I grant you, but they had mud.
Yes, I gather that Rotorua, where this festival that they're planning is going to take place, has no shortage of mud at all. And why then does the local authority spend nearly $100,000 on importing mud from South Korea?
It's partly a fair question.
Yeah, partly it's because one of the council went to South Korea, saw the mud festival there, thought, this is great, we must have this in New Zealand, and decided that you ought to have the mud to go with it. When put on
so
the
I'm
spot...
I'm also a bit stuck on the idea of mud festival. I mean, the reason I stopped going to rock festivals is because that's what they generally turn into, especially in this country.
Yes, but I guess there are people at the other extreme who actually love the mud. And the article has got lots of pictures of people, obviously very happy people, covered head to toe in mud, faces where you can just about see the eyes through clods of mud. Clearly, this brings sort of great glee to lots of people. And I think, you know, the final quote has to go to the chief executive of the festival, who asked why they imported the Korean mud, said that our mud is geothermal, but theirs is more cooling. Think about it.
$90,000 well spent. John Everard, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Finally tonight on The Daily, this weekend, London's Old Truman Brewery will be celebrating all things Portuguese at the Imminente Festival. It's a showcase of street art, music, food and more from both Portugal and other locations around the globe, put together by the Portuguese street artist Vilch. His signature style uses drilling to carve detailed works into the concrete spaces that surround us, with permission, one would hope. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall stopped by the festival site to talk about street art and more with the man himself.
What I usually do, I work with hammer drills and hammers and chisels and so on. So often do is I go on walls, and instead of adding paint, I extract the layers of the wall. So it's kind of a contemporary archaeologist process of the cities where I go and do projects. That's the concept of basically revealing all the layers of that the walls in the city have in them by an act of destruction that creates something, that makes something that is invisible visible on the walls in different cities. The relation that I have with London is quite strong because I lived here for 7 years, and it was a huge influence for me with all the projects that we did, from Cannes Festival to different other projects. So for me it was really meaningful to do these projects back in London after all these years that I was here.
And we should sort of tell listeners about what it is we're seeing. I mean, you've got a piece over here which is sort of carved from a piece of enormous concrete, it seems to be. This isn't just a case of you taking a jackhammer to a wall and making a mess. These are like really, really intricate, beautiful, detailed portraits of people. And it's quite sort of jarring to see that this sort of slightly destructive process could create something quite so beautiful. But does everyone see it like that? Because you are essentially taking a drill to a wall. I mean, I assume you maybe got in some trouble maybe in the past before.
For sure. I mean, I started as a graffiti writer doing most mostly illegal stuff, which was part of my, you know, background, and definitely this idea of doing something by yourself, DIY kind of posture, it was there because of graffiti. But the work evolved a lot, conceptually, and the carvings that I told you, I eventually did it on walls, billboards, and so on. And of course, some people saw it as vandalism, which I completely accept. But the idea is not. I often work with places that are forgotten by the city. So the fact that you can actually carefully take care of a wall and peel those layers to create something beautiful that will create and resonate to people, it's something that is very impactful, not just for me, but for the place that is being done, but also for the city to claim attention to those places. And what we're going to see here in the festival is a different concept and a place that people are coming to receive an input. So all the artists were able to push the limits of all their techniques, because most of these artists work usually on walls, and here we pushed it on sculptures, some walls also, but most of the artists push it on sculptures, and that gives an interaction to the public completely different, because we have more time to work on a concept, on a piece, than if you work on a public space. And I think that's what people could expect here, is to see every artist that is here to push their work in concept and form.
And tell us about some of these artists then. I mean, we've got a real spread. We've got people from all over Europe, all over the globe, really. But I mean, you do have a pick of also some Portuguese artists, in, you know, both musicians and street artists too. Tell us what we can expect from Portugal, and what it is about the Portuguese art scene that you think is sort of should be shown more to the world.
The idea was not to centralize it completely on Portuguese artists, of course. As I grew up there, there's a lot of artists that I respect and that I wanted to work with them here. And we all came together to do something very specific and special. But we have artists from Ireland, from different, completely different places. And what we were trying to do is to show, you know, the potential on when people can work together or with a common objective. Because with visual artists, usually you don't have the barriers of languages, of cultures and everything, because people go on and have a common goal, a common objective of showing the art, claim attention to issues that art can do. And I think what we try to show here is that when we work together with a common goal, things can, you know, be quite special. We have several artists and musicians from all over, and that was the main objective of the festival.
And finally, I was looking at your piece earlier, as I was explaining to listeners, it's this sort of concrete monolith. It looks about 10 feet high, 8 feet wide, and you've drilled these sort of little chasms into it, and you've created this incredibly intricate sort of portrait of a figure. Tell us a little bit about what that artwork is. Do we know who this person is, or is it just a creative vision? What is it?
No, usually I work with unknown icons, so people that I everyday heroes that live in the cities where I work. I do a series of portraits, and I try to capture the essence of the city. And this was one of the first sets of drawings that I did when I was living in London. And then I did a big research on top views of the city that kind of creates this maquette of a city that it's made with from different parts of London that then compose the portrait. And it's, and the whole idea of the piece is, you know, it's like something that crystallizes how we are shaped by what's around us, by the cities where we come from, by everything that we do, and how little sometimes we affect the place where we live. And that's basically the whole motto and the concept behind the work that is there.
That's fascinating. So within that detail of the facial marks and things like that, you sort of worked in sort of, I guess, the geography of London as well.
Yeah, that's what you can find there.
That was the Portuguese street artist Vils speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. The Imminente Festival takes place at London's Old Truman Brewery this Friday and this Saturday. And that is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Tom Hall. The researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maya Sonico Hegard. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now with Georgina Godwin. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Millett. Thanks for listening.